Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hey, a quick note. Now that I'm fully vaccinated, I'm going to take advantage of that. We're going to have a jailbreak, so I will be taking a short one-week hiatus from both the podcast and my daily newsletter, Morning Shots. We're going to go visit the family out east. So, hang in there. Try not to ruin the country while I'm off, and then I'll be back a week from this coming Monday. And so, joining us on the podcast is another one of our vaccinated colleagues, Bill Kristol. But happy Friday, Bill.
Well, to you too, Charlie. And it's going to be tough for the listeners to do without you for a week. But they need to be reassured that you're coming back. It's not some kind of Lou Gehrig type situation, not to make light of that, obviously, because that was a terrible tragedy.
Just a road trip, no Lou Gehrig type thing.
Good. Well, enjoy the road trip. Enjoy being unvaccinated, as you and I discussed in the past. Enjoy being vaccinated. We've been vaccinated for, 3 weeks since fully vaccinated, so to speak. And psychologically, it takes a while to assimilate that you kind of are vaccinated, and you can really, if you're seeing someone else who's vaccinated, or frankly, even if you're not, even if that other person isn't, you are, and in our case, our wives are. And so you don't quite have to be quite as like, gee, well, I'd love to get together. Let's have coffee outside. Let's look at the weather to make sure it's a decent day before we go out on the deck. And then it's like, wait, why am I going outside? I'm not either going to hopefully catch anything or did anything, right? And since I'm vaccinated, it takes a while psychologically to assimilate.
It does. And it's interesting you said that, because I have this kind of mental block about it. I will get over it. I'll get over it very, very quickly. But I think we've both been vaccinated for more than a month now. I think I had my first shot, and I think it was February 1st, and then was a month later, March 1st. So it's been more than a month, and I haven't gone indoors to a restaurant. Yeah. So I will get over it.
Hey, I did last week, and it's nice. There's something insane about how fantastic it feels after 13 months to have someone pour you a second cup of coffee. It's like, wow, it was breakfast. This is the lap of luxury, having, eggs over easy and home fries and someone pouring you coffee. So,
well, that's what I'm looking forward to is getting back to life and learning to appreciate getting back to life more, like little things like that. Before we start, hey, I got to thank you. You mentioned, I think the last time you were on the podcast, a couple of shows that you'd been watching, or maybe it was a different podcast you were on, but you mentioned Broadchurch.
Yes.
And my wife and I watched that, and we watched all three seasons. And I have to say, that was an outstanding choice. So I appreciate it very much. And I think you also mentioned the French series Spiral, which I have not yet gotten, but I'm getting lots of emails from people who heard you recommend that, who are also saying that that was excellent.
So Spiral, I'm really glad you like Broadchurch, which I think very is much. One of the best that I've seen of the kind of British police types. Hinterland is very much like it. If
Hinterland.
Yes, which is set in Wales. And then Spiral, we've watched a few episodes of it. It's a little grisly, I guess you'd say, kind of a little darkish, which is okay. And it's sort of that's the whole thesis of it almost is, it's the underside of Paris, not the Paris the tourists see. And of course, you get to see people speaking French, which is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. You can pretend your French is getting better, even though you're reading the subtitles and stuff. So actually, we started watching another British series. I'm not going to blank on the name. It's two women detectives, Bailey and something. Look it up. It's good, actually. We're just in the first season. But it's funny. I'm so late to this, and I didn't really watch much of these. TV improved, and I noticed 20 years later that there was a whole new world of Netflix and Amazon Prime and HBO series that were actually at the same quality or maybe higher quality, don't you think, than movies at this point?
There's no question about it. We're in a golden age. The thing that surprised me about Broadchurch was, I like British mysteries, but sometimes they're a little bit too mild. My taste runs a little bit more for Ozark and something like that. My wife, likes the, milder, no guns, no blood sort of thing. But Broadchurch was so intense, was way more intense than your average British murder mystery, and it is not as grisly or graphic as an Ozark, but it really captured our attention. We binged through season two and season three in just a couple of nights. And we generally don't do that sort of thing. I mean, it's smart. It's well acted. It's well written. It's well conceived. And so anyway, I highly recommend it. Okay. So Bill, before we get into other things, I am obsessed with this whole fundraising scam story that the New York Times reported over the weekend and the Tim Miller Advance in the Bulwark yesterday. And I know that you and I both have seen many, many, many fundraising scams over the year and understand there's a dark underbelly of fundraising, right? I mean, let's be honest about it. This is most fundraising appeals are not put together by nuns sitting in a room with ethicists, right? I mean, it's but the story over the weekend. So here's the original one. You know, about how the Trump campaign scammed its supporters into making these recurring contributions, draining the bank accounts of some of the most vulnerable supporters, including retirees. And basically what it was, what they would use these pre-checked boxes so that if you donated $50 or $100, you were then required to manually opt out of making these ongoing contributions. And they made it more and more complicated to do this. And this was intentional on their part, right? I mean, you know, they were facing a cash crunch. And so they began, it started in September, set up these recurring donations by default for online donors every week until the election. And there's just some really just horrible stories of people living in hospice care and veterans who ended up, you know, losing thousands of dollars. In the end, the Trump campaign had to make refunds of more than $122 million, which is huge. And so that was horrific. That was the weekend. So you fast forward to yesterday, and our Tim Miller in the Bulwark has this fantastic story about how the National Republican Congressional Committee is doing the exact same thing, continuing to do it with these amazing wrinkles. So you have a fundraising appeal and it says you have to make this contribution, $50, $100, $250, $500,000 for the congressional committee. And then they have these two pre-checked boxes. I have to read them because you can't make it up. It's checked. We need your help to draft Trump for president, ! Check this box if you want Trump to run again. Uncheck this box if you do not stand with Trump. And then, of course, if you check it, then your donation becomes monthly recurring. And then the other box is Trump patriot status missing. As a top grassroots supporter, we were surprised to see you abandoned him. This is your last chance to activate your update your status to active. So, I don't know, where do you want to weigh in on? I mean, just the fact that it's a scam is one thing. The fact that the congressional committee is basically using your loyalty to Trump and getting you to try to support Trump to run for president in 2024, I mean, that's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, so 2 points. The first, that the name of the show I mentioned that you should watch, if I could just get, once you now that you finish with Broadchurch and once you finish with Hinterland, which is also very intense, is Scott and Bailey. They're two women detectives.
Excellent. Okay.
And they're 5 seasons, and it's sort of not as intense quite as Broadchurch, but more intense than your old fashioned British.
And if you don't watch it, it's proof you don't love America.
Yeah, exactly. Scott and Bailey. Yeah, it's good. It's a little, I think they sold it as like, wow, it's all women, you know, women, not all women, but I mean, these two protagonists are both women. It's one's so accustomed to the pairs, right? The man and the woman. But it's actually very interesting and quite psychologically, I think, astute. Okay. I mean, for me, there's a lot of scams online and fundraising, God knows, and all this, but and some of them are illegal and some aren't quite. The fact that the Trump campaign, I think what people should focus on is, campaigns sometimes do, they do return money if requested sometimes if they've misled people, and there's a little bit of this recurring donation stuff going on. No, I don't know of any major campaign, any, you know, national level campaign that's returned $120 million. I think they raised something like $600 or $700 million. So like they had to return a fifth of the money. And again, this wasn't the FEC, to my knowledge, it wasn't the FEC coming in and telling them they had to. It's their own people. So their own supporters. So not
been
people
ripped
like you
off.
And me. People who wanted to give money to Trump, saying, wait, I've been ripped off by the person I wanted to give money to. And I didn't realize I was giving, you know, making a monthly contribution. And then so that's widely denounced. It's reported. They had to give all that money back. they gave that money back. And then the NRCC just picks right up on doing it. And of course, all the talk about how we're just the congressional committee. We want to have a, you need to have a Republican House because we need to make sure Biden doesn't pursue socialism. But then their selling point obviously is Trump. It's all about don't betray Trump, don't desert Trump. And even as you say, Trump 2024. So what about all that liberation from Trump? What about how you don't have to be a Trumpy person to donate? You can just be some old-fashioned Republican who thinks, you know, the Republican economic policies are better. They've tested. What's for me, the final point, what's revealing, though, is these things are tested, of course, very elaborately and carefully, right? Which appeal works better? They do simultaneous tests, beta tests, whatever you want to call it, of all these different appeals and different boxes and checks. It's clear the Trump appeals work. That's very revealing, isn't it? I mean, right. For those of us, unfortunately, for those of us who would hope, well, there's a lot of Republican voters out there, maybe more particularly the kind who give money, you know, who, you know, they want the more traditional Republican-ish tax and other kinds of, you know, appeals. No, the people who are writing the check, sending in the money on their credit cards want the Trump appeals. I guess the Marjorie Taylor Greene, you probably followed this more closely than I. Those numbers were pretty astounding too, right, in terms of her fundraising.
Yeah, and that's why this is relevant, because this is the center of gravity of Republican fundraising, or maybe all political fundraising right now, online fundraising, and what shakes money loose from people's hands. So, okay, this actually gets worse. I read to you the first two boxes. And Tim actually added to his story yesterday afternoon. He says, if you can believe it, there's an even worse version of this running on the NRCC's fundraising page, where they actually threaten to tell Trump that you are a defector. That's the word they use, all in caps, defector. If they uncheck the box for recurring donations, they have to read it. Okay, now keep in mind, this is aimed at their people, their supporters. These are people who have already written out checks or given their credit card to give money for Republican congressional candidates, but they still threaten them. We need to know we haven't lost you to the radical left. If you uncheck this box, all in caps, we will have to tell Trump you're a defector, all in caps, and sided with the Dems. Check this box, and we can win back the House and get Trump to run in 2024. And this makes it a monthly recurring donation. I mean, wow, you're a defector. So you've given $250 to Republican congressional committees, but we're going to rat you out to the former guy and say that you've aligned with the radical left because you're a defector if you don't make this a recurring contribution. I mean, as I wrote in my newsletter, great googly moogly. I mean, really, this is just, what do you say about this except that they've tested this and apparently this is what works. This is intentional. This is purposeful. It may be crude, but this apparently is what works. This kind of threat works with the grassroots, or they think it does.
I mean, there's a Gresham's Law, I guess. I think that's the right use of that term. In political rhetoric, which is, you know, if one thing gets normalized, things then get worse, everything gets more debased. And Trump himself, of course, let's not forget, normalized the use of the words like traitor in attacking the opposition party, incidentally, on very mild things where they differed, actually, where the Democrats in Congress, mm-hmm. not mild, but I mean, normal policy differences. And people like us said, oh my God, this is a new low. That's a word that's used very rarely, and when used, usually criticized, or maybe when used for really, very intense foreign policy differences at the height of the Cold War, yeah. and so forth. And now they're using it routinely to attack the opposition, and God knows he uses millions of other words like that, including implying they're not real Americans and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, the sophisticated defenders of Trump, the conservative elites and stuff. Well, okay, that's Trump. I don't know proof of that. But of course, it's going to be contained to Trump, and none of the rest of us would do that. And here we are. It's now normalized in the Republican Congressional Committee appeals. And normalized, obviously, you look at the rhetoric of the candidates. Josh Mandel, whom I knew a mm-hmm. little bit, was totally
running for Senate in Ohio.
Yeah, Republican running, young, ambitious Republican running in Ohio, and won state treasurer twice, lost a couple of Senate bids, one I think he pulled out of and lost one. But and now is attacking not Democrats, incidentally, but Anthony Gonzalez, a Republican congressman who voted to impeach Trump as a matter of a true courageous vote, a conscientious vote, but a pretty conservative Republican otherwise. attacking him, I think literally used the word traitor.
As a treason, traitor.
Treason. I mean, so it does, you know, it's hard to get that toothpaste back in the tube of, you know, could we have a civilized politics? It really is hard. And it spills over. Now, some people are resisting it and some people just don't criticize it, but they don't quite go there themselves. You know, that would be more the Mitch McConnell types, I suppose. But you know what? This is, for me, the big lesson. We've discussed this a bit in the past, but it's a new version of it almost. You know, if you don't criticize it, it gets worse. You can't take the position of
a
benign neglect or, you know, I'm just not
going to be the
best. You know, right. I don't want to be in the middle of that. Well, that's a very nice, fastidious thing to do. And in your personal life, you have no obligation to get in the middle of things you think are stupid and unattractive and, you know, just let other people fight them out. And sometimes in politics, that's okay, I guess, if you think they're going to kind of wear each other out or something. But in this case, when the fate of one of our two major political parties is at stake, it is not acceptable, it turns out. It's not responsible to sort of do nothing.
No, we had tried that. So I wonder whether defector is going to be the new term, which, by the way, is kind of like a throwback to the Cold War, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, defect to the Soviet Union, somebody from the Soviet Union defected to us. It's not the kind of word that comes up in daily conversation. And yet this is it, that we will have to tell Trump you're a defector. And sided with the Democrats. The stupidity of this is on one level, but also, and I said this yesterday, I think that this really reflects the GOP's deep contempt for its own voters.
Yeah.
That they think of them as marks and as rubes, and they're willing to try that. And it's the assumption on the part of the elites, like the Kevin McCarthy's of the world, the people running the Republican Party, that they can rip off their grassroots in this particular way. So you saw the Gallup poll yesterday, the Gallup poll showing that through the first quarter of the year, an average of 49% of Americans identified with the Democrats or said they were independents who leaned toward the Democrats, compares with 40% who identified as Republicans or leaners. The 9-point Democratic edge is the largest Gallup has measured since the fourth quarter of 2012. In recent years, Democratic advantages have typically been between 4 and 6 percentage points. So this would at least be one data point suggesting the Republican Party going in this particular way is shrinking. Although I have to mention, you know, it's hit this low in the past and been able to bounce back. But 40% is a warning sign for Republicans. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's funny. I did a conversation with James Carville yesterday morning, which will be released actually later today. I'm not sure when exactly, but it should be up on the internet when people hear this podcast. And so that's an audio and video conversation, Conversations with Bill Kristol. People can go to that and take a look. And we've done a zillion of them, as you know, Charlie, over the years, and I've done them, and every 2 weeks release them. Often academics and other economists, but this is with James on politics and very interesting on the Democrats. He's quite alarmed about the left wing of the Democratic Party, but also sort of optimistic about Biden and very hard-headed about the current political situation. One thing I asked him, well, what polling questions do you look at just to help people kind of get a more sophisticated grasp of what's happening? And he mentioned that one. He said, the one thing I like to look at always, and I always put it in my own polls, when I'm doing polls, how do you self-identify? And you obviously give them a choice, strong Democrat, weak Democrat, leading Democrats, something like that. You push the independents when they say independent. Well, are you sure you're not leaning one way or the other? So you try to get a real sense of you don't let people just get away with saying, well, I don't like either party. You say, well, which way do you lean? Now, still you get about 10-12% who say, I don't like either party. But and he said, he mentioned this, he's seen this in a couple of polls, he said around a +10, +9 Democratic edge, and that's pretty high. It's not, you know, super, you know, dispositively high, but it is stronger than the average 4-6 Democratic. It's strong. And if you just think of the race, Biden won by what, 5%? I think Democrats won the House national vote by about 3.5 or 4%, I think. So maybe Biden was 4.5% in the popular vote. I can't remember. So, you know, if you think of that as kind of a benchmark, then 9% would suggest some movement towards Biden since Election Day, presumably driven, or towards the Democrats since Election Day, presumably driven by maybe by January 6th, maybe by Republican craziness, maybe by Biden, you know, doing a pretty good job on the vaccines and whatnot. I mean, you can look at it both ways. In a certain way, part of me thinks, really, it's like it only moved 4 or 5 percentage points after the craziness of the last 5 months, you know. But it is a real movement. So they're paying some price. It makes me wonder, you know, this is actually, speaking of the conversations with Bill Kristol, Andy Zwick, whom, you know, I think I've met, he's the kind of producer of them. And he's very interested in politics, of course. And he's had this speculation for a few months that maybe it's all bad. Of course, what's happening with the Republicans, and he reads your newsletter and JBL and everything, and Bulwark Plus member, and is totally in agreement. But he sort of also wonders, could it be a bit of a bubble? I mean, it's gotten so crazy. It's sort of like, you know, we've discussed this maybe in the past too, that, you know, these you know, you start, these things start off and then they go longer than you think. And they go to more extremes than you think. That's very true of stock market bubbles, right? But eventually it kind of pops. And how much can this get more and more crazy? Are more and more Senate candidates going to accuse Republicans who don't agree, who aren't worshiping Trump, of being defect traitors? And is more and more fundraising emails going to go out accusing everyone who doesn't, you know, keep renewing, keep sending in $50 a month of being a defector? And does this culture war craziness just get worse and worse and worse? Maybe it does. I mean, that's the question. Or maybe it's permanently the way it is. Could there be some point where people just look up a year from now and it's Biden's been president and the world, and, you know, they don't like some of the policies and the government's sloshing out too much money, but we're not living in a socialist country. We're not living in an unfree country. Foreign policy is pretty mainstream. And people look up and say, you know, some of that was a little crazy, some of that stuff. I mean, I don't, that's his suspicion that that could happen, or maybe it's his hope, but I don't know. Do you think it could be kind of could the craziness of the right be kind of a bit of a bubble?
You know, a couple of years ago, I had a conversation with somebody, I would mention them, but it was a private conversation, and they made the similar point about political bubbles, that they tend to burst right after they appear to be unstoppable. That they grow and they grow and they grow and they become very, very confident, and it looks like they have become dominant, and that's when they burst. And you think about what's going on right now, where you have all of the craziness, it appears to be dominant. And so Republicans, what they're doing is they're, of course, all doubling down, going further and further, you know, calling people who disagree with them traitors. The craziness appears to be, well, it appears to be required at some point. Is that unsustainable? And of course, our fear is, well, because we've lived with the growth so long, that maybe it will be sustainable. But the reality is that, look, you know, unless the entire country loses its mind, you know, they're going to pay a price for this. Now, is it possible that the country could lose its mind? I mean, that is possible, right? I was telling you that I was considering making my next book, The Idiocy of Everything. but I don't know where you go past the title. It's one of those titles that just sort of covers everything, right? You don't actually need to read the book because it's right there. But yeah, no, I think that that's true. So let's talk about the politics of infrastructure, because it occurs to me that the two political parties have completely different theories of the case. The Democrats believe that if they grow the economy, pass substantive legislation, put money in people's pockets, send them checks, build things, that they will be rewarded by the electorate. The Republicans think that it's not about economics at all anymore, that it's all about culture war. It's all about attacking the elitism and playing the grievance cards. And that even if the economy comes back, and even if they build bridges and all of that stuff, that they will successfully be able to run on, this has become so old now, cancel culture, woke corporations, et cetera, and that it is the cultural issues that are still moving people, hearts and minds, more than the actual substance of legislation or money, that it's no longer, that it's not the economy, stupid, anymore. What do you think?
I mean, it is the right question to ask, and I think you're right in characterizing the bulk of the two parties. Obviously, the woke left has its version of a performative kind of culture war symbolism, and think that that's the right way to do politics, and think they deserve credit for screaming and yelling on their side. I mean, the Biden people are old fashioned and thinking that, you know, you probably should judge most of these policies by their consequences. And are they actually, you know, are the vaccines getting out or not? And will these economic they're willing to be judged, I think, by the consequences of their economic plans. People like you and me think there's probably too much money there and it's sort of a little overdone here and the Keynesianism on steroids. But, you know, they'd say, fine, let's pass it and see. And I think they would say in a grown up way, we're making it, a judgment here, a practical judgment that there's a greater risk of spending too little than too much, or we've underspent in infrastructure. Whatever arguments they make, they're familiar political policy arguments, and one could make the counter arguments. On the culture can be important. One other thing I'd say is, so yes, against that, there's a kind of performative politics, which is taken over 2/3 of the Republican Party and maybe 1/3 of the Democratic Party, which generally is unhealthy, I would say. I mean, there are real cultural issues, if you want to call them cultural, which are legitimate issues. I mean, Is there going to be a Hyde Amendment or not? Is the federal government going to pay for abortions or not? Obviously, marriage was an issue. I think it's kind of over, but it was a legitimate issue on which people differed. And there was a sort of old view and a new view. And so, but what's striking is that we're not even at that level of discussion. Some of that was always a little bit kind of performative, you might say, or symbolic. But it was also had real policy consequences. Whereas now, I mean, there are policy consequences. So you have Republican legislatures passing bills on something like transgender issues, which are, I think, somewhat complicated. And I wouldn't claim to have studied the medical literature and so forth. But I'm tell you what, these Republican legislators sure as heck haven't studied any medical literature or, frankly, talked to anyone who's gone the family, who's had to make some decisions about.
I think that's a fair assumption.
17-year-olds. Yeah. And they're just passing stuff. So that really is, I think, another level of perniciousness. I mean, I suppose there's always been a little bit of that. If you were tough on crime, you found some way to symbolize that by, three strikes, you're out or something. But again, those were still other people could say, well, wait a second, shouldn't you make it, 20 years, not life in prison, whatever. I mean, there's something really not just creepy, but dangerous, I'd say, when your politics becomes entirely a matter of gesture and performance and symbolism. And one reason, look, this was the original neoconservative and the very old-fashioned sense of it, 50-year-old sense, critique of the left. They didn't care. You'd show this poverty program doesn't work, and they didn't care because they wanted to say they were passing poverty programs. And that is not a healthy way to run a country, because ultimately you end up with a lot of programs that don't work and are counterproductive, and the same with education and a lot of other areas. And that's become, I think, the Biden people, to their credit, mostly have accepted in a way that critique and they're sort of trying to find things that they think will work, with a fair amount of some identity politics thrown in, obviously, and all that. But the degree to which the right, think of that. So they have this massive government stimulus program, which is susceptible to a lot of good old fashioned conservative Republican policy arguments, both economic policy, but also how are you going to spend that money? Do you have confidence that the institutions know how to spend it well? Shouldn't you try to do it in an incremental way? I mean, very normal kind of common sense, moderately conservative arguments. We're hearing almost none of that, are we? I mean, has any Republican congressman given a speech where he's laid out, where he said, I like parts 1, 3, and 6 of this bill. I think part 5 is okay, but it spends too much. Parts 2 and 4 are just a mistake, and here's why. The money's not going to solve what you think it's going to solve. Does that discourse even exist in Republican circles, or frankly, even in most conservative circles anymore?
Well, I think the discourse right now is to say that it's not all the infrastructure, focusing on the word infrastructure. Right. So, for example, Marsha Blackburn famously had a series of tweets where she said, they are spending, X billions of dollars on, care for the elderly. That's not infrastructure. What she doesn't then go on and explain is why caring for the elderly is a bad thing. Right. I mean, that's what she got dunked on. It's like, okay, so not everything is infrastructure. And, speaking of dumbing down the issue, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York had that silly tweet yesterday. Paid leave is infrastructure. Childcare is infrastructure. Caregiving is infrastructure. And I understand that people, the Democrats rally around her and say, look, don't leech all meaning out of the words. Because if everything is infrastructure, then the word means nothing. Then unicorns are infrastructure. On the other hand, as you point out, Republicans are having a hard time explaining why these things are bad. Okay, so you may say broadband is not infrastructure. I think it is infrastructure. But is that a bad thing? Are we against putting in broadband? And this is also part of this weird incoherence where the Republicans want to be the working class party, but it's not clear what they ever actually want to do for the working class. Have you noticed this?
Right.
That everything about the working class appears to be the culture war stuff, not stuff like, hey, let's get you a job building bridges, you know, laying train tracks. Let's expand the minimum wage or create more paid leave programs or things that would actually change the working class, except to play into their sense of grievance, the fact that the elitists don't like you, et cetera. But no, we're not really having a substantive debate on infrastructure. Could I go back to the point you made, though, for some of our listeners? I think it's important. This, you know, politics as virtue signaling, because you hit one of my buttons. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, I grew up in a liberal household, a very, very liberal Democratic household. And, grew up actually being an activist in Young Democrats. But one of the things that began to disillusion me was watching how good intentions often had unintended consequences. So, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, you had a lot of people on the left supported programs that were disasters that actually ended up hurting the people they were designed to help, whether it's urban renewal or so, or AFDC. And when you pointed out that hey, you know, this actually is destroying these communities or making people's lives less well off, you know, you'd often get the blowback. Well, you shouldn't judge it on that basis. You should judge it on the basis of our good intentions. We are the good guys. We need to do virtuous things. And therefore, there was a sense that they didn't really care about the actual real world implications. So when you're talking about, you know, politics as virtue signaling, a lot of conservatives now remember when it was the left that was willing to embrace just disastrous policies because they cloaked themselves in their good intentions. And a lot of conservatism was a critique of that, which, again, makes it ironic that now the right has become the party of just sort of performative virtue signaling.
And I think from the point of view of democratic self-governance, there's always, of course, there's always going to be some of that. And intentions do matter as well. And so but a healthy country, a healthy, well-governed country has to care about the actual consequences of policies. And maybe not, it can also care about intentions and about signaling a little bit. And that is, you just look at this debate. I think if someone came down from Mars and looked at our current debate on a major set of economic proposals and compared it with the debate of 1981 about Reagan or in the 60s about the Great Society, or in the 2000s for that matter about, I don't know, Medicare, Plan D or whatever, you know, or even Obamacare, honestly. I mean, those were actual policy debates, and there was a lot of argument about would Obamacare actually help the people who claimed to, and would the exchanges work well or not, and then you still couldn't choose your doctor. There's a certain amount of just symbolic kind of screaming and yelling on both sides and invocations of virtue by the Democrats. One reason people like me, incidentally, I suspect in retrospect, were even unwilling to think about the arguments for Obamacare as much as maybe we should have, or elements of Obamacare, is it was so annoying, all the virtue signaling on the left, right? That you had to be for this because otherwise you didn't care that 30 million Americans didn't have health insurance and might not get the health care they deserve. And it was annoying being told that. And you would say, wait a second, those people can get health care. We should look at ways to help them get it better. But this is an inefficient and sometimes counterproductive way of helping them. And then they would scream at you that you didn't care about people who had a pre-existing condition and were having trouble getting the help they needed. So the virtue signaling on the left probably, you know, in a way, I think hurt them among some people, at least in terms of taking their policy seriously. And now we have such virtue signaling on the right and such performative politics on the right that I worry. I mean, will anyone ever be able to make a limited government, free market, incentives matter type argument again? And will anyone listen?
Or are they interested in doing it? I mean, so you wrote about Matt Gaetz today, and I don't want to spend the whole podcast on Matt Gaetz, but it's kind of a symbol of this performative politics where, you know, Matt Gaetz, wrote in his book that if you're not making news, you're not governing. And, you know, like of this whole new generation, these are not people who appear to have, they're in office, but they're not that interested in governing. They're not interested in legislative outcomes. They're certainly not interested in legislating. It is all just performative. It's all brand, no actual substance.
And again, there've always been people like that, and they usually were sort of on the fringes of their parties. Some of them were, you know, they were show horses, not workhorses, right? That was kind of the inside. That was the term that was used. Some of the show horses, you know, became pretty famous, and I suppose they were show horses so they could run for president and all that. And so you always have a mix of show horses and workhorses, but the mix is now so skewed, somewhat skewed in both parties, I've got to say, and somewhat skewed in our culture as a whole, of course. But so much more on the right. That, and again, the whole point of the conservatism, in a sense, was to try to the critique of the left was exactly that: this, where are the workhorses? And now that's just really disappeared. I mean, it's really shocking how it's the degree to which the whole concept is sort of gone, so far as I can tell, from Republicans in the House, with like five, two exceptions, you know, and not much stronger in the Senate either. And even Republican governors. So governors are the ones who really were workhorses. They actually governed states, and they would be judged by results. And now we have, you know, governors of major, major states, Greg Abbott in Texas. You know, you'd think, okay, Texas has done pretty well so far as I vaguely can tell. And I mean, leaving aside COVID, but, you know, in terms of economic policy and people are, you know, companies are flocking there and Austin's booming and Houston. And you'd think that, okay, that's a pretty impressive case for Republican governance, I would guess. I remember, in fact, you and I are old enough to remember when it was a kind of a very standard, but I think somewhat good conservative talking point that let's just compare Texas and California. These are states. They have nice climates mostly. You know, they both have a lot of immigration. They have a lot of things in common. And they've pursued sort of different policies because of the politics of the two states. And let's see where people are moving to and where business is going towards and who's doing a better job. And Texas isn't perfect, God knows. But, you know, it was a pretty reasonable argument for Texas. You know, and Rick Perry, who we now think of sort of a somewhat goofball politician, but actually tried to make that argument when he was running for president. You know, look at my actual record as governor of Texas. And now, I mean, you don't even get a word of that, right, from Governor Abbott or DeSantis in Florida much either.
No, and they've become very, very showy. So, okay, let's talk about John Boehner, speaking of folks. Okay, so the former speaker, he has this new book out. I haven't read the book, but there's a long excerpt in the New York Times today. And, you know, here's a guy who really lived through the crack up of the Republican Party, really were driven out of the speakership by, some of the people who became the Trumpiest folks. So he's got the new book's going to come out this week. And it's it has a stinging denunciation of Trump, saying that the Trump incited the bloody insurrection on January 6th, and the Republican Party has been taken over by whack jobs. Let me just go a little bit, some of these quotes here. He said, he writes that Trump's refusal to accept the results of the election not only cost the Republicans the Senate, but led to mob violence, saying it was painful to watch. He said, I'll admit I was not prepared for what came after the election. Trump refusing to accept the results and stoking the flames of conspiracy that turned into violence in the seat of our democracy, the building over over which I once presided. Watching it was scary and sad. It should have been a wake-up call for a return to Republican sanity. Whatever they end up doing or not doing, none of it will compare to one of the lowest points in American democracy that we lived through in January 2021. So then he goes through, and he obviously is very, very critical of other Republicans. So your thoughts? He's writing this book now.
I imagine it's an entertaining book, and there's probably some genuine, lessons to be learned from it. Some perceptive analyses of things. He's an intelligent guy who was in the middle of stuff. And I'm glad he's saying what he's saying about January 6th and the Republican Party now. I mean, I wish he had said it a little more forcefully. I am sure he said something on January 6th or 7th. I don't remember. But I don't remember him on January 13th calling congressmen with whom members of Congress with whom he served, including from the state of Ohio. But of course, there are many with whom he served as speaker and many who were close to him, and saying, you know what, you should vote to impeach this man. And I don't remember him saying that to Rob Portman, his senator from Ohio, on when the Senate voted on conviction. So, and in general, I don't remember him being that outspoken over the last 5 years about the threat of Trump. And in fact, our friend Amanda Carpenter has, you know, dug up a couple of very nice things he said about Trump in 2016, and certainly endorsed him. I think 2020, he may have just sort of sat out. One of his aides said, he wouldn't get involved in this mess for
anything. Well, that's right. I mean, now he had a chance to speak out in 2020 when it was on the line.
Right.
And clearly he had no illusions about the Republican Party or Trump. And yet when he had a chance, he did not come out against Trump during the 2020 election. So,
And nor did Paul Ryan. And, you know, this is maybe they didn't vote for him, but maybe they did. But anyway, they did nothing. And so, you know, I mean, you're in Wisconsin. I don't know. And it was close. And that was the closeness of those races made it easier for Trump and the Republicans to sell the big lie. I mean, I'm not saying they wouldn't have tried even if he had lost the national vote by 9 points instead of four or five and lost Wisconsin by 150,000 instead of 20. But it would have been easier the bigger the margin. I don't know. Could Paul Ryan have moved some votes in Wisconsin? Could John Boehner have moved some votes? Could
Bushes
have moved some votes? Maybe not. Maybe no one was listening to these ex-office holders. But I don't know. Kind of everyone should have tried, in my opinion, you know. And surely they all thought Biden would be a better choice than Trump. And certainly now would agree that Biden, given January 6th especially, and Trump's behavior after the election, was a better choice than Trump. And crickets across the board and all that from these a lot of these ex-big shots, not all of them. I think that's been bad for the country, and I just think it's a failure. And not that everyone has to weigh in on everything, I understand that, but on a fundamental choice in 2020, on a fundamental fact of the big lie, and now Boehner is weighing in on that, so that's to his credit. But again, I'm not sure he did quite as much as he might have. I guess he's waiting for his book to come out, but the broader critique of the Republican establishment, the business establishment, conservative elites, I would very much make that there was the ones who kept quiet were better than the ones who acquiesced publicly and sort of justified, and they were in turn better than the ones who enthusiastically got all on board Trump and the big lie. But even the silence, they could have done better.
Well, the thing that's fascinating about Boehner, of course, is that he saw this crack up close and personal before he quit. And he actually writes in the book, apparently, that talking about the members of the House and Senate who supported Trump's efforts to overturn the election, he writes, "Some of the people involved did not surprise me in the least. The legislative terrorism that I'd witnessed as Speaker had now encouraged actual terrorism." And so he bailed out. I guess you think back on that and, all of the signs of the crack up of the Republican Party were there, and yet he was succeeded by Paul Ryan. So there was that sense that we weren't going in that direction. But Paul Ryan turns out to be a parenthesis rather than an inflection point, which obviously is tough. So what do you make of this? We haven't had a chance to talk about this. Make of this new quote-unquote war between the Republican Party and corporate America. Awfully interesting. Mitch McConnell, who you and I both have known as the number one advocate for the free speech rights of American corporations, now turns on them and says they should stay out of politics. And if they keep getting involved in politics in the wrong way, which means not writing him checks, that there will be dire consequences. What do you make of that?
Again, they're discrediting what's not a foolish argument, which is on the whole, it's better for corporations, to kind of be restrained in their political activities and in their political virtue signaling. And, you don't want the whole culture, the whole country to be politicized in every respect. And I would say the same about sports teams and sports leagues and so forth. And there's a practical question. This is, again, a very old-fashioned consequences matter question, which Stacey Abrams actually was worried about, which is if Major League Baseball – they have the right not to have the All-Star game there. And there were some reasons to make that symbolic choice. They're also, practically speaking, hurting quite a lot of people in the Atlanta area, many of whom are minorities and don't deserve to be hurt because of something the Republicans jammed through the Georgia legislature. So, but now it's all, against the Republicans have decided. There was that memo from the head of the, I think, Republican, was from Banks from Indiana, urging McCarthy, we've got to be the party of the working class. And it's all, it's either all nativism and anti-immigration and that kind of thing, or symbolic stuff. And there's no actual policies. So, I don't believe Mitch McConnell is going to embrace a lot of anti-corporate policies. In fact, they're going to pretend not to drink Diet Coke for a while, I suppose, and try to keep – it's part very much of a piece, I guess, as we're coming to the end of this, I'll just say it this way. It's very much of a piece of what we began this podcast with and which you spoke about so well, which is the NRCC fundraising appeal. It's the exact same thing. It's all performative. It's all – lets them have the rubes, you know, can be convinced that we don't like corporations because we're going to criticize Coke and Delta. But let's not have a serious discussion about, I don't know, tax policy or anything like that.
Right. No, it's going to be sort of a fake slap fight. You know, look, we're, you know, because not one Republican is going to vote to change the corporate tax policy. So, Bill Kristol, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it very much and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Charlie, and have a great break. And we're eager to have you back, obviously, as soon as you finish that break.
Yes, and I will be I'll be off next week, but I will be back a week from Monday. Thank you all for listening to this weekend's special Bulwark Podcast.